Good morning. Today, I finish very briefly to discuss what we did on Friday on the quantization of the scalar free field. And then I'll go to how to treat by the same method the interacting 5-4 theory, which is the simplest theory which involves the scalar field and which has some sensible meaning. In fact, it corresponds to the Higgs sector in the standard model, and it's plays a role in many areas of quantum physics and statistical physics. So, in fact, I wanted to show you a few pictures, but before, let me just remind what we did. We are considering the scalar field yesterday, on Friday, the scalar free field with action in, so it's a field phi of x with x in space-time, it's a real field, and the action for the field is in the Euclidean setting integral d of x 1/2 of d phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared. In the Minkowski setting, this is a weak rotated action, so this is integral dt dx of 1/2 of dt of phi squared minus 1/2 of dx of phi squared minus m squared over 2 phi squared. I'm sorry, this is d. Okay, and I should have written that. Anyway, you know that by heart, I hope. And therefore, we want the integration by path integral methods amounts to compute by some integration over the field, some functional integral with some measure, a factor which is minus 1 over h bar s, the Euclidean action, if we are interested in the theory at imaginary time, and in Minkowski's real-time setting, we have an integral of the same measure, I over h bar s of phi. So this is, as long as you don't look in the detail, the same receipt than for the path integral, Feynman path integral in ordinary quantum mechanics. Okay. So now, and we have seen that at least briefly, that if we want to compute the vacuum expectation value, I'm going to come back to this later, of two fields, phi of x and phi of y, by this functional integration method, this is called the propagator, we get just the ordinary propagator that we got in canonical quantization. Therefore, this is in Euclidean setting, 1 over the matrix element of minus the Laplace operator between the point x and y, so it's just a matrix element of this differential operator in the Euclidean setting, while in the Minkowski setting, where you use the trick of weak rotation, and this corresponds to vacuum elements of time-ordered products of operator, you get, and if I'm not mistaken, if you work out the high factor, this is the matrix element, there is a high factor, and you have delta minus m squared plus I epsilon plus between the point in space-time x and y, where delta is now the Laplace operator in so that's the D'Alembertian in Euclidean set time. So with the outshows of metric, where we have in Minkowski settings, the settings, the metric minus, plus, plus, plus. Okay. Which is the Feynman propagator? So, in fact, this is just the first of lots of results, and one get the expected result when you compute expectation value of products of more than 2 phi, 4 phi. So in fact, the Vick theorem is valid and can be derived by functional integral method by exactly the same kind of method that I've discussed on Friday. Since I want to go a bit fast, I will not make the calculation explicitly. You can find it in the notes of last year's. But I'm going to go back to and give an idea of how to derive it by more general method. Okay, so just at the moment here, assume that the Vick theorem allows to compute expectation value of more than two fields operator are different. Okay, so that's the first. The second thing that we want to discuss is that it's something that you have seen in past, I think in the canonical quantization. If you want to compute this two-point function, that's the two-point function. Well, you know it's the Fourier transform of 1 over t squared plus n squared. So it's something like integral over dk in d dimension of 1 over k squared plus m squared with a vector exponential I a times x. Those are four vectors. Well, work out in whether it is in Euclidean or Minkowski space. But one of the main properties of this object is that when x goes to y, when the two points are very short separation, and in fact, when x minus y is much, much smaller than 1 over the parameter m in the mass of the particle in the action, you can very easily see that this behaves like some constant, which depends on the dimension of space, and times some power of x minus y. So by rotation invariance in Euclidean settings, this is just the distance between x and y. In Minkowski space, it's going to be distance. But anyway, you can guess what it is simply by notice that k has the dimension of the inverse of a distance. So this has to be zero. So you have an integral over k something which is over the k squared plus m squared. So this is dimension of k. Therefore, this has dimension of the inverse of a distance. So just by dimensional analysis, you see that this has to be proportional to 2 minus d, where d is the dimensional space-time. This is the dimension of space-time. In Minkowski space-time, d equals 4. Okay. And you see immediately from this result that when x goes to y, there is a singularity. Okay. This is singular when d, well, I'm sorry, when x goes to y. So, okay. And this is singular if the dimension is in fact larger or equal to 2. Well, you may object that in dimension 2, this is just a constant. But in fact, you work a bit more carefully, you realize that you have an integral of d2k divided by k squared. So this is a logarithmic divergence. So in fact, in dimension 2, this object behaves like log of x minus y. Well, it has to be positive, so there is a minus factor. There is a factor which involves a factor of pi. And if you are worried about the fact that this is a distance and the log of a distance, something that doesn't exist, you have this unit of momenta here in the mass. So in fact, this is a function of the log of x minus y times the mass in the Lagrangian. And this is a perfectly well-defined number, dimensionless. Okay, so in dimension two, you have a logarithmic divergence. In dimension three, this is minus one. So in dimension three, this behave like one over x minus y. In dimension four, this behaves like one over x minus y squared, etc.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Can you go over why this two-point correlation function is proportional to constant x minus y to the 2 minus t?
No, it's not equal. It's you just do this argument of dimensional analysis.
It's not
okay. So by dimensional, you see, by dimensional analysis, it has to be a function of x times a mass factor, which is just the global. And if you like,
why doesn't it have y inside the integral?
Pardon?
Why is it just a function of x? Why is it also a function of y?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's
I-K-X-Y.
No, it's a function of x minus y. Oh, I'm sorry. This was a typo of mine. Of course, this is just the parameter. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes.
This mass here is not physical mass, right? As I remember, it was the mass that we have here, M,
yes.
Is not physical mass.
It is a physical mass because we are dealing with a free theory, no interaction. So here, M is the mass of the bosons. We have Klein-Gordon particles, they have a mass, and there is no renormalization. Of course, this is going to be a bit more complicated in interacting theory. Yes?
Why is it times D? Why is it proportional to the dimension? Like,
no, it's not proportional to the dimension. Here, it's a it's a number which is depends on the dimension. And I wanted to skip that, but if you go into the notes, and if you like math, you are going to find that all the values of the dimension, of this constant for different dimensions. And in fact, there is even a specific formula for the propagator, which is somewhere, you'll find that, in fact, the exact function, so this is an approximate function when x minus y is smaller. And if you like math, you find that the exact formula is, I found it. It's proportional to 1 over 2 pi, 2 pi times the distance, so the absolute value of the vector x minus y, divided by m to the power 2 minus the dimension of space, divided by 2 times some Bessel function of the second kind of x minus y times m. Okay, so if you know the properties of Bessel functions by heart, you'll find that when x minus y is small, there is a singularity here, this thing here, and you end up with this here. Okay.
Maybe you can just do a change of variable, so k times x minus y is 2.
Of course, you can make a change of variables somehow, but well, you have to be a bit of more difficult. But that's basically, you see that if the distance, basically the argument is that if x minus y is very small, what counts is the integral are so k which are very large. So that this is over the one. This is where the oscillation of the take place. If k is very large, k is much larger than m squared, so you can forget the m squared. Then you have an integral over from dk, 1 over k squared. So it has to be, it must have this dimension in terms of momenta, or in terms of position, and here you just have this. That's the only available number. So that's it. Of course, it's a physicist or engineer argument. If you want to do the math, you have to be do the calculation more precisely. And if you do the calculation precisely, you get this exact formula. It's not very difficult to get. And you open some textbook in special function, and you find that this has precisely this behavior at short distance. Well, there are also other ways to study it. Anyway. Okay, so the important point is that the two-point functions are singular at short distance. Okay. And that's a phenomenon which in quantum physics is called the existence of ultraviolet fact, they can be viewed as divergences or short distance. And short distance means also short time because we are in space time. Okay? And it's also called high energy. Energy momenta. Singularity. Okay, that's just a different name from this. And ultraviolet means because the wavelength of the ultraviolet is higher than is smaller than the wavelength of ordinary length, so it means shorter. So you'll find often in the literature UV singularities in short for those short distance, high momenta, high energy singularities. Okay. So, what does this reflect? This reflects a physical feature of quantum fields. It reflects that quantum fields are highly correlated at short distance and are infinitely correlated, in some sense, at zero distance. And you can view this by just in the functional integral formalism by just asking what are the typical classical field configurations which contributes in the functional integral, not just the classical one, but the one which are near a classical configuration. So they undergo some kind of quantum fluctuation in the path integral. But still, they contribute. They are the one which contributes when you compute the quantum effect and the propagator. And can you activate the? Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I just want to show you a picture that you can find in the notes. So I'm going just to show some kind of samples of field configuration. And let me in D equal 2, let me just show this. This is a typical sample in 3D. So these are the two dimensions, and this is a 3D picture of a function in three dimensions. And you see that the typical field configuration is very spiked. Here it's not infinitely spiked because I'm discretizing space-time on a lattice. But you see that it's very spiky. And the more you, this is on a rough lattice, a quite crude lattice, or the same size but cruder lattice with larger mesh cell. If you decrease the mesh cell, it becomes more and more spiky. Oops. So the fact that the two-point function diverge at short distance just is a mathematical, consequence of this behavior. The typical field configurations that contributes in the path integral are very, very singular configurations. Okay, that's life. That's what how the quantum world looks like. You can play the same game in three dimensions. Again, this is for a crude lattice. There are fluctuations. Cruder, it's So here, of course, I'm in three dimensions. I'm taking a 2D section of the field. It's more difficult to. I would need to live in four dimensions, but anyway. So this is a section in 3D, and for finer and finer grid, it's more and more spiky. And if you worked out a bit how it works, it's way more spiky in three dimensions than in two dimensions, because remember, well, I erased that, but in three dimensions, the divergence is 1 over the inverse of the distance, while in two dimensions, it's a log. So the higher dimension, the spikier the field here. And I wonder if I have some. So that's what I wanted to show. We just keep in mind this picture. It's more detailed in the lecture notes. But those divergences, you know, are physical features.
What we found which diverges
is. Pardon?
Correlation function. The thing that we found that is diverging is the 2-point correlation function, not the field itself. I don't really understand what are you exactly plotting here. Is the like. You
here,
have the
here I am. I have a path integral discretized on the lattice.
Also, you're plotting the path integral.
No, I am plotting. You know, you have a path integral, so you have you take an average or a super quantum superposition of many field configurations. You take one of these, but you take one which counts, whose action is not too large compared to the. The action of a classical configuration, which would be field equal zero. The classical solution of the equation of motion are solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. So if you have in a finite space, for instance, with periodic boundary condition, or an infinite space, but you don't want plane waves, then phi equals zero. That's it. Okay? So what I just wanted to explain is that these are physical singularity. Yes?
And when you say they're physical singularities, are they, is it correct to say that they're a symptom of the computation relations?
Of the?
The computation relations of quantum mechanics, that we can't localize the field without having. Because Feisberg,
yeah,
the mass, so that would be like the energy.
You have to be more careful. This is a mass of the excitation of the field, but in fact, there are a consequence or the feature that leads to the fact that you have non-trivial commutation relation between the operator in a quantum theory.
But like,
that's it.
This limit that we can add. X minus y much smaller than 1 over m. It's exactly the limit that, like, it's the limit that our theory breaks down because of these computation relations. Like,
we are dealing with a perfectly well-defined quantum theory. You have constructed it by canonical quantization in Dan's course. So it is complete. It's a complete theory. There is an Hilbert space. There are operators. The theory is consistent. Simply, some quantities become infinite when you try to compute them at coinciding points.
Sorry, I don't understand the divergence theory. If you take y to be as equal to x, and
yes,
that would diverge, it means that the particle is propagating at that particular point, and the two-point function is diverging?
It doesn't mean anything non-sensible for a particle.
What does it mean then? Here
I'm not computing properties of how particle propagates. I'm computing properties of the operator which correspond to phi.
But isn't that the propagator, what you calculate?
It's called the propagator because, well, I'm going to explain that a bit later. It's called the propagator because it's a matrix element between, it corresponds to some evolution process, but a very specific one.
Okay.
So.
Will you so you'll explain that.
I'm going to explain that I think a bit later. Or but it's not the it's not what is called here the propagator. You shouldn't take it as just the same object that what is called the evolution operator or the propagator in quantum mechanics. In the literature, one uses the same name because there is a strong analogy, but it's not the same object. So this doesn't describe the propagation of a given particle. You know, phi is a field operator, so it contains already the states with a lot of particles. And so it's a superposition of states with many particles, because we are dealing with a quantum theory with bosons. So,
what is the physical meaning of this diverging right now? I mean, without doing
the physical meaning is just what it is. Some correlation function of in a quantum field theory have to diverge at equal time and equal space.
Like actual, because that's a mathematical.
It's a physical feature and a mathematical property of the theory.
But what does it mean physically? Like the correlation function, isn't that kind of a probabilistic, you know, idea of like, you know, computing a matrix element, like getting from point X to point Y, right? That's the probability, sort of. And so would the divergence be like the probability is becoming?
Nothing diverges when you consider a physical process.
Okay.
Okay, so, well, let's come back to that later, I hope. Because at that point, I'm not treating the propagation of particles or whatever. But remember, what we have computed using canonical quantization in Dan's course makes perfect sense. And here, this is just a different mathematical representation of the quantum theory or a different way to compute the same physical quantities, the same transition amplitudes. So.
But this one has divergences.
There are divergences in the regime which correspond to what's happening at infinite energies.
Okay.
Yeah. So it means simply that the behavior at infinite energy of a quantum field theory is different from the behavior at infinite energies of a quantum non-relativistic theory. That's what it means. So you have to pay attention to that. But it doesn't mean that the theory is inconsistent at finite energy. Okay, so let me stop there, but I would be happy to discuss with you later. And let's go back now to interactions, where we'll meet again all those features of a quantum theory. Okay, so now, what about interactions? Okay, so the interacting pi to the 4 theory. So as we already discussed, and I presume Dan discussed in his course, why should we consider phi 4? First, it's the simplest case, so it's a good training ground for more physical theories like QED with fermions, gauge theories, vector particles. Here we have just scalar bosons, particles with no spin and no charge. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is in fact that this is the X sector in the standard model. So it's part of the big game. Okay, but we keep this theory. We have a scalar field, phi, which describes some massive bosons, or massless. They may be massless, but either way. But bosons in zero. And now, those bosons interact. And how do they interact? If you want to have bosons which are not free to propagate like that in space. This is the trajectory of a boson. If you want to interact, but interact in a way which respects relativistic invariance, the only possible interaction should be contact interaction. in QED, there are interactions between matter, between the fermions, because it's mediated by a gauge field. There is another field. But the interaction between fermions and photons is contact. You see, so it's the same thing. That's analogous to the fact that in QED, the interaction between the photon and an electron is also contact interaction. Ah, more in it, but okay. So, and contact interaction basically can be represented by adding to the action S of phi. Let me write it in the Euclidean setting in order to have no I factor, but to add to the action which describes the physics of non-interacting bosons, a contact interaction. And the contact interaction, you see here, if you remember a bit the Feynman rules, you have a particle which somehow corresponds to a phi field, another phi field, and you have an outgoing phi phi. So it's not difficult to see that the interaction is described by a phi 4 interaction. So the products of four fields, each field, so two phi correspond to the ingoing bosons and two phi to the outgoing. It's going to be worked out later. Okay, so this is interaction. Now, what kind of the interaction must have a strength. The strength is described by a coupling constant that I'm going to call G here. And I'm trying to make my G not look like 9. So G is the coupling constant. It measures the strength of the interaction. And you can, if you think a bit about it, you realize that G has to be positive, which corresponds to a contact repulsive interaction. Two bosons doesn't like to be at the same place in space-time. And okay, so that's a repulsive interaction. And you may very well say, okay, but we could consider a model where the bosons are attracted at short distance.
Sorry, if bosons can occupy the same place at the same time, if bosons usually, generally can occupy the same place at the same time.
They can occupy it the same time, but that's the problem. You know, if bosons likes to occupy the same place, which would be the case if G is negative, then they will condensate. Okay. So this is okay for bosons. If G was negative, they will condensate. They will condense all at the same place. And this leads to singularities. We are in a relativistic theory. We are not, we know that in ordinary quantum mechanics, bosons can condense. That's the phenomenon of leads to Bose-Einstein condensate and to the phenomenon of supraconductivity, etc. But we are in a relativistic case. So that's base. So G has to be positive for the theory, as this theory to be consistent.
To see the singularity
One can see it, but when working more. Anyway, you can also, but you can think something about like that. This is now a potential for the theory. So let's call it V of phi. Okay, and this potential of interaction has a function of or the value of the field phi, you know, it's a Gaussian when g equals zero. When g is not zero, it's anharmonic. It's, you know, steeper at large distance of the field. But if g was negative, it would be something like that. And it would be bottomless. So we will be dealing with a quantum theory which cannot have any sensible ground state, even classical ground states. Okay. So that's one of the many reasons why you consider G to be positive. Okay, so this is the action for the 5-4 theory. Oh, by the way, I'm going to, for normalization factor, to add a factor of factorial 4 for simplicity. That's something standard. It's just a denormalization. Okay, so this is the action for the interacting 5-4 theory. And well, if you want to deal with the theory in Minkowski space-time, that's the same rule, simply. You replace this by dt phi squared minus dx phi squared and minus the potential term. Okay. So this, you replace this by v of phi. Okay. So that's going to be important. So v of phi equal m squared over 2 phi squared plus g divided by factorial of 4, that's what, 24 pi to the 4. And I'm very bad at writing 2s. So this is a potential. Okay. So this is a theory that you have seen, I think, a bit in Dan's course in the last part of his lecture. So now, how do we quantize by path integral, by functional integrals? Well, we just apply the same Feynman receive to a quantum field theory. So we are going to compute physical observable matrix element using something that looks like, let me write it here, because some integral of a d of phi exponential, and if I am in Euclidean setting, this is SE phi. But now SE of phi contains this phi 4 term. Okay. Okay. Or in Minkowski, integral d phi exponential of I over h bar SE S of phi, the action. Okay. Okay, and the purpose of functional integral is just to compute matrix elements of operator which can be used to do actual calculation, for instance, computing transition amplitudes using the LSZ, the Lehmann-Simonsky-Zimmermann reduction rules that you have been introduced to by Dan. Okay, so the idea of using a functional integral is to compute correlation, what's called correlation functions, which I'm denoting phi of x1 up to phi of xn, okay, which corresponds to in the Minkowski, in the real-time matrix, to matrix element in the vacuum of t time-ordered products of operator phi of xn. This is now the physical vacuum of the interacting theory. Okay, so those objects are called correlation functions, but they are in literature also called green function, especially in the Euclidean setting. And in the Minkowskian setting, they are sometimes called, well, in the mathematics, Whiteman functions. Whiteman is very well known. Well, he's dead now, but mathematical physicist that worked a lot in defining in a mathematically proper way quantum field theories. There are axioms called Whiteman axioms, that axioms which tells you which mathematical axioms should satisfy those correlation functions in order to define a sensible quantum field theory. Okay, so sometimes you are going to meet those term correlation function, Green function, vacuum expectation value, and Whiteman function. That's more or less the same thing. Okay, good. So, the rule when we compute those Green functions is that this should be given by path integral with minus 1 over h bar s of phi, if I am in the Euclidean setting. And then I insert phi of x1 up to phi of xn. So I'm computing the functional integral with phi of x1, phi of xn inserted in the average over all configuration field. And in order to project on the vacuum, I divide by the same thing, exponential of minus 1 over h bar as e of phi. Okay, but this is the action of the interacting theory in both cases. Okay, so this should be equal to this. Okay, and well, the best recipe we have to now to compute in general theories, which works but which has limits, is to use perturbation theory. So perturbation theory means considering that G is small and expanding G. So perturbation theory expand in powers of the coupling constant G, assumed to be very small. Okay, and if you do that, you are going, in fact, to recover the Feynman rules. Of canonical quantization. Just because Wick's theorem works here. Okay. So there are details in my notes, there are details, example where you compute explicitly. How you can expand this quantity in terms of Feynman diagrams. And I'm going to reproduce that a bit later. So, but let me remind you that the Feynman rules for the you obtain both in canonical quantization and in path integral is simply that time for a break. So remember that you have Feynman diagrams. And you have propagator, so the propagator is just the object that I've wrote here in momentum space, well, in position space in 1 minus delta Sm squared. In momentum space, it's 1 over p squared plus m squared. That's in the Euclidean setting, and in the Minkowski setting, that's minus I over minus delta plus m squared minus I epsilon plus, and here it's minus I over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon plus. That's Minkowski. That's Euclidean. And the interaction vertex, which represents the interaction, is the interaction vertex. Carries just a coupling constant factor, which is minus g, where g is a coupling constant in Euclidean space, and that's because the path integral is exponential of minus s of v, and so you get a minus exponential g by 4. And in Minkowski setting, this is going to be, you have e, but you have still a minus, so it's, you get a minus I time g per interaction vertex. Okay. And when writing this, I didn't took into I didn't pay attention to the 1 over h bar. So if you do get the calculation, you see that there is a 1 over h bar which divide everything. So if you apply the Vick theorem, you get an h bar factor here. You get an h bar factor here. You get an h bar factor here, and you get a 1 over h bar factor here, and 1 over h bar factor here. That's not very important, because you can reorganize everything by setting, choosing a system of unit where h bar equals zero, equal one, I'm sorry, h bar equal one, and be chosen by some normalization. So as long as you don't look at the semi-classical limit, that's fine. But remember this. Okay. So now that's time for a break. And after a short break, 2 minutes, say, I'm going to introduce a general formalism to deal with, to show how to compute those correlation functions in path integral, which is called the formalism of the generating functional. So I'm going to be in the opposite order of what is done in the lecture of the previous year, where I first introduce the rules, Feynman rules, and the details of perturbative calculation, and then introduce a generating functional method to deal in a general way with all the correlation function. Here, I choose to do the opposite, to show the power of functional integration. Okay, so let's go for a break. And maybe I'll look for some water. I'll go for some water. Fine. Ah. Right, it's open. Ah, thanks. I look for some glass. But there is no glass. Okay.
You're a young
vegetable.
Pardon?
Sorry?
The microphone might be still on.
It's not working? No, it's working. Pardon? It has to work. I see.
Just to make your
operator
bond.
I think it's worse than that. Because in any quantum theory, you have operators which are bounded and operators which are not bounded.
It's not worthy of.
More related to unitary.
Okay,
I might return to that next week. Mention.
It seems like just calculating endpoint function cannot distinguish the sign of the G because all the field numbers should be even. That means if we bring a perturbation, always all the propagator.
No, you are wrong because in fact the interaction vertex. See, the interaction vertex has a sign of G, and this involves four. So the at leading order, the 4-point function is proportional to G. That corresponds to the interaction, two incoming vertex, two incoming particles, two outgoing particles. I don't know. Yes?
The propagators, the reason we don't have I epsilon in a Euclidean picture because there's no contour integral? Why is there an I epsilon in the Lukowski
profile? That's because that's what I explained very shortly on Friday. Where if you write the Fourier representation, and in fact, and actually, when you are doing calculating actual Feynman diagram where you integrate over internal momenta, this P squared plus M squared as a pole, because remember. Well, is minus k squared plus m squared here p squared minus omega squared plus k squared if p is omega k. So you and you integrate over omega both on omega k real. So you have those poles on the real axis for omega, and you have to. To make precise what causal perception you need to use to recover the propagator. And this is the causal.
And if you look at the Euclidean picture, we didn't have.
In the Euclidean setting, p squared is omega squared plus k squared. So the poles are somewhere in the imaginary plane. So you don't need to care about them. You don't meet them in your integral. It's when you do the weak rotation, you meet them, and therefore you have to be a bit careful. But the correct way to do that, that I explained on Friday, tells you that it has to be this in order to get the time ordered products. If you choose different prescription, you can get what's called the advanced propagator, the retard propagator, the anti-causal propagator, etc. Well, so no water for me. Well, that's okay. Okay, so let me start again.
Are you going to go through the derivation process of this thing, or
I'm going to show how to compute and recover somehow the Feynman rules using some general methods. But I will be I will go quite fast. So we'll see. But you'll see.
Kind of curious as to why we have an H bar numerator for that
property. That's just because I take as an action one. So the factor in the action is 1/(h^(S)(i).
Yes.
Okay. So that's it's just the Feynman rules, ordinary Feynman rules. And I think in the QFT1 lectures, H bar is there is a normalization of the field so that H bar is hidden in the coupling constant. I'm going to explain that a bit later.
Oh, okay. So there is an H bar in the coupling.
Well, there, in QED there is an H bar.
Yeah.
Because the coupling the parameter is the fine structure constant alpha, and alpha is a combination of the charge of the electron and H bar.
Yes.
So H bar is there, of course, but I'm going to show this. Okay, so well, I think I don't need much of this anymore. So maybe, well, maybe that's better if I use this again. But erase this. Okay. So, oh, that's very good. This, I'm going to explain what is the method of generating functions. Function ALF in quantum field theory. And it relies on something called a mathematical object, which is very easy, which is just a generalization of usual derivative to derivative of functional. A functional is a function of some function. So I'm going to give the simplest example, which I'm going to use that. Remember, I think I already introduced an object which was called g dot phi, which is a shorthanded way to write integral of a dx of g of x times phi of x, where g of x and phi of x are two functions. And I'm going to use, when I will write this, phi will be the quantum fields, which means which is integrated over. And g of x is going to be a classical field, but it's a variable which is going to be called the source term. Okay, so take this as a definition. And now let's add this into the functional integral in the following way. I'm going to define a path integral, functional integrals, which depends on this source term g, which is a function of space-time, simply by defining the path integral with exponential of, well, minus 1 over h bar s phi. And this is for the Euclidean action. And I'm adding to the action minus g times phi, where g times phi is the integral of a space-time of g of x phi of x. Okay? So I'm calling this the generating function for the quantum theory. And so you see that when g equals 0, you just get the ordinary partition function. But in fact, this is a functional of this source term. Of this source term g. And now let's introduce the concept of functional derivative. Okay, functional derivative is that you have an object that depends on g, and you want to compute what is the derivative, the partial derivative of this object when you vary g of x at some point. So the functional derivative is denoted delta divided by delta g of x of some functional which depends on g. Okay, and the only rule you need to know about functional derivative is that they behave like partial derivative, but...
Sorry, are we in four dimensions, three dimensions?
I am in any dimension. In this case, this formalism is valid for any dimension. So, yeah, so it's, I'm sorry. This is d d of x. Yes. Yeah. So x is a vector. Okay, and the only need is that you know that you saw this object is a linear combination of g of x and the phi of x. So when you take the derivative with respect to g of x, you get something proportional to phi of x. Okay, so by definition, this is phi of x. Okay, and this is phi of x because basically, you take a derivative with respect to g, and phi doesn't vary. So in fact, the rule that you have to know is that if you compute the functional derivative with respect to g at the point x of g at the point y, remember, this is an integral over y of g of y phi of x, you get the delta function in d dimension of x minus y. So these are the rules. And in fact, this result is a consequence of this. Okay. So it's just, you see, this is just a generalization for functions of the partial derivative of a function of several variables, where here you would have a Kronecker delta of the indices between the two functions. It's just that. It's an infinite dimension, infinite generalization of partial derivatives. Okay. Okay. So now.
I feel like I know this, but why is it generally true that the variation of the function at a point y is not dependent on the variation of that function at point x, where y and x are not?
Exactly. It's just that I'm stating. It's nothing more.
Why is that true? Is it obvious?
It's exactly, you know, if you, exactly the same thing that it, imagine that you have a function f on some of some numbers. Well, here I have x for space-time, so let me call them something different, something like c or a. A1 up to AN.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, in particular, you may consider the function AI. So if you compute the functional derivative of AI of AG, this is delta IG. It's exactly the same thing. Simply, there is a, since we have a continuous set of variables, we have to put a delta function. Well, you know, this is a Kronecker delta function. So delta IG is 1 if I equal G, and is 0 if I different from G. Here you have a delta function, and you may ask, aha, but delta when x equal y is infinite. But in fact, it makes sense when you apply this. So this, for instance, I can derive that if you prefer. Delta, I'm computing delta g of x of integral over dy, g of y, phi of y. Okay, so this is integral dy delta g of y divided by delta g of x. This is y and this is x times phi of y. So this is integral dy delta of x minus y phi of y, so this is phi of x. I am in d dimension, but this is delta function in d dimension. You see, so this is a consequence from this, because of the delta function.
The set of fields phi,
yes,
and j under that inner product, is it an inner product vector space?
Yes, this is the definition of the inner products between two functions. Okay. Yes?
Why does phi have no j dependence? Why is there not a product rule where you have plus del phi del j there?
Why is it? I'm sorry.
Why is there no product rule where we have plus del phi del j?
Well, there is a product here.
Yes, but why is there no term where you add plus j times del phi del j?
Well, if you mean what happens if it doesn't depend on J?
I think the question is, why is there no Leibniz rule? Yes. Why is there no Leibniz rule where we have another term with the derivative of phi with respect to J?
Zero.
Because phi is a different variable than.
But how do we know there? Like,
maybe it's by
dependence.
By definition, here, G and phi are different functions, independent variables. And I take the derivative with respect to this function. Of course, if phi was a function of J, for instance, if you had taken phi equal G squared, well, then you apply the ordinary rules, but you have to take the derivative with respect to this and the derivative with respect to this. I'm going to give an example.
So there's an assumption that phi is completely independent from J.
Yes. This is a rule when phi and G are independent. Or otherwise, and you apply the ordinary rules of composition of derivatives. Then everything works as it works for partial derivatives. Okay, so now now take this big function, which is defined as a very formal object, and take a partial derivative of this object with respect to this one. So, by the definition, if I take the functional derivative with respect to the source term at a point x1 of exponential of minus 1 over h bar. There is a minus here. And there is a minus here, so I get a plus here. Plus G phi. Why do I get? I apply the rule of ordinary derivative. So the derivative of the exponential of something is the exponential times the derivative of what is. So this is exponential of 1 over h bar. G times phi times the derivative with respect to J of this, which is 1 over h bar times phi at x1. Okay, I hope you are convinced. It's just the rule of what is the derivative of an exponential. Okay, hence, yes. Repeat. This and take the functional derivative of G, take n functional derivative at n different points. Of Z of G. Well, each time you take a derivative, there is a h bar 5x that falls down of the exponential. So what you get is, well, you get a h bar to the power minus n, and then you have integral d of phi, exponential minus 1 over h bar s e of phi minus g times phi. And then what do you get? You get phi of x1 up to phi of xn. Okay.
Wait, sorry, Francois. I'm a little confused. Okay, so we go back a few steps to the delta j y,
yes,
or delta j x. So here you were giving the example with this Kronecker delta, which is,
yes,
1 and 0. But here, since it's a delta Dirac delta, it would be infinity, right? Infinity when x is.
No, I have no infinity because you see. I get just phi of x1. There is no delta.
Okay, I mean, I guess that's what happens when you do it inside the integral. So is it really just like a definitional tool to be used in?
It's a calculational tool.
Okay.
The rules of calculation we did, which are definitions,
okay,
you apply to this big object and you get this.
Okay, fair enough.
But you'll see that it's a useful calculational tool. Okay. Because once you have a phi of x1, this term doesn't depend on g, on j. So you the source term. So no derivative will act on this one. So ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Okay, and well, this is a functional integrals which we need to compute the partition function. You see? So you take the functional derivative. Divide by z of g. So I have n different points. Or rather, set g equals 0 here. After the derivative, then the term disappears. So you get up to h bar minus n, integral d of phi, exponential of minus 1 over h bar s e of phi, times phi of x1, times phi of xn. Okay. Divide by z of g at g equals 0. You divide by d of phi exponential minus 1 over h bar plus e of phi. Okay? And this is, by the rule of path integrals and of quantum mechanics, the correlation function phi of x1 phi of xn. Okay?
The vacuum here is
non-interacting field. No, it is interacting field. It's a correlation function for the interacting theory. This is a partition function for the interacting theory. This is a generating function for the interacting theory. So this is a correlation function for the interacting theory.
That J could be any function, right? Why did you introduce it as classical field source term?
Pardon?
J. It could be any function. And then we could write our partition function in terms of that any arbitrary function. Why should it be classical field source term? I mean, like, how
this classical source term is introduced in order to compute the correlation function of the phi operator.
And we could introduce any functions, like all of this derivation.
You could introduce, for instance, another source term for another operator, like phi squared, phi 4, of course. But that's the simplest case.
I mean,
but that's the only case we need.
How do you know that it's source term? It could be just a function of x.
But you see, g is a function of x. I'm still using for that this notation that g means.
Does it have any physical meaning of like sourcing the field?
It has a physical meaning, and that's why it's called a source term, because you see that having g different from zero amounts to changing the potential v of phi, which is basically phi squared plus phi to the four, with m as n, into v of phi plus g times g of x times phi of x. You see. So it corresponds to some external field coupled to x, coupled to phi of x.
Like a so it actually.
So that's what he called, it's called a source term. It corresponds to some classical external field.
So it couldn't be just anything, like there is a relation between our potential in Lagrangian and this source term. So we're somehow constrained on how to pick this J. We couldn't just put the information.
You could do more things, but this is a choice I choose. So I introduce this field J of X, but J of X is taken as a variable, but I don't integrate over it. So when I do the path integral, I end up with a function of this classical field, and when I compute the external, the functional derivative of this functional for g taken at different point x1, xn, I get the correlation function of the quantum theory. Once I have set g equals zero, j equals zero, okay?
Just for clarification, is there any reason why we say phi x is a quantum field?
Pardon?
I'm
using the poor notation that phi of x is a quantum field because that's a field that is integrated over in the functional integral quantization scheme, and therefore it is phi, which is by correspondence principle related to the phi operator in canonical quantization, or in, you know, phi in the functional integral. Functional integral is in correspondence with the phi hat operator in canonical quantization that you have seen in a quantum theory course. Yes?
Can you explain why this expression is equal to correlation function? Because we are not using the LHC reduction formula, but somehow we are.
No, I'm not using no. I'm computing correlation functions, so vacuum expectation value of operator, but they are not of. There is no Machel condition. LHC reduction formula comes later to compute matrix element.
So if my action was for the action for a phi Kleinward in phi,
yes,
then this correlation function would give me the correlation function with respect to vacuum, free vacuum.
Of course.
But the fact that this is interacting is just hidden in the action, and they don't need to apply any LHC.
No. Of course. Why? No. So this is valid for the interacting theory, and if you set g equals zero, then you recover the correlation function of the free theory, the Klein-Gordon field, that you can compute using Zwick's theorem. I have not computed anything at that stage, so the difficulty is going to come later. Anyway, okay, so basically, this z of g is a generating function for the correlation function. Yes.
I have a more trivial question, just notation. You have an h bar inverse to the power.
Yes.
Is it included in your definition of
the? There is an h bar. I'm sorry. Yeah. There is this h bar minus n. Yes. In addition. Yeah, this is why the H bar is a bit annoying, but I'm going to keep it for later. Yes?
So when you evaluate that, that at j equals zero, you get the denominator?
We get?
The denominator there, like just the exponential to the action without the field?
For the free theory, this is the partition function, so this is the determinant of. But for an interacting theory, it's more complicated.
But like this you get that denominator from setting.
It's just a normalization which is given by the Feynman rules, which I wrote here. This just comes from the Feynman receive of path integral quantization for a quantum theory applied to quantum theory. So this is just Same manner. Yes?
I still don't understand what the physical meaning of J here is. You're saying it's an external field corresponding to phi of x. You added this so that you can account for the external legs, so to speak, of your function
yes.
diagrams. So what this is adding to your action, well, I mean action, this would be this is an extra term that is accounting for the action of your external legs? Is this part
yes.
of the...
Yeah.
So that would be the interaction act with the SE of phi, SE, the action that you had before, the Euclidean action. That would be your interaction action?
It contains interaction, and we had just another terms. You can view it as the interaction of the field with a classical external field that you use as a probe to study the quantum theory and the vacuum of the quantum theory.
But I still don't understand. So, your V is comprised of phi squared and phi.
V is
phi
written
four,
there.
Yeah, I know. But I understand that. But what is exactly, because J can be any function.
J is any function with, yeah.
So you're saying, I feel like you're saying that your external field, if it is a physical object, can be any function and you don't have any constraint on it.
Yeah. Yeah, if you look for a physical interpretation of this, it's just an external classical field and you have your theory, your quantum theory, living in a background which is classical. And in fact, here this is just math, a way to construct a mathematical object, functional, which contains all the correlation function. So that if we are able to compute with this correlation, this subject, we can compute at once all the correlation function of the theory. That's its property.
So
but if you want to see...
Actual physical object, it's not. It's just...
It's just a mathematical formalism which is useful. Okay.
We could treat it as an external field.
You can view it as an external field, but in what I'm going to do, I don't need that. Now there are some physical problems where you have such an external field which has a physical interpretation. And in fact, there are examples of quantum theory where you have some classical fields. So then, take a quantum theory with light particles coupled to very heavy particles. For instance, in the standard model, you have light fermions and heavy fermions, mesons, and the Higgs fields, which is very heavy too. And if you want to construct an effective quantum theory for the light degrees of freedom, you can treat the heavy particles as classical field. As long as you work as at low energy, you don't excite particles, massive particles out of the state you are considering. So that's one example. Another example is just consider quantum theory coupled to gravity.
Oh.
You see? So you treat general relativity as a classical theory, and you treat your other quantum fields as quantum fields. And then, in order to do that, you just have to replace the Minkowski flat metric by Riemann curvature, so the classical solution of the equation of motion for the gravitational field. And then the metric tensor acts as a classical external field for your quantum theory. And it's valid as long as you are doing quantum theory way below the Planck
yeah.
energy, which is the only thing that we can do at that level. You know, in high energy physics, people they need to think about what happens at Planck scales, whether it gives some constraint. And of course, people working in quantum theory, including in quantum gravity, well, including myself when I work on that, we have to do that. But for ordinary life, the gravitational field is treated as a background field for a quantum theory.
This is a dumb question, I suppose, but okay, so if we can put the general relativity as an external field inside our quantum field theory.
You can.
It's not going to be. Where does the problem between relativity, general relativity, and quantum field theory occur?
It occurs when you go to high energy of the order of the Planck scale.
You need that as well for. Why do you need that? Why do you need to
work? Well, wait for your course of quantum gravity, where I think maybe it's. Well, I think Ruth Gregory is going to speak about cosmology, but she will discuss that a bit. Okay. Well, okay. So I'm going slowly, but I hope to convince you that this object is generating this G, let's say. So what you need to remember is that Z of G is a generating functional for the correlation functions. Phi, phi, phi in the vacuum of the theory. Okay. And from the perturbation rules that Dan told you, this is a generating function for the all the Feynman diagram of the theory. So for instance, for a 5-4 theory, you know that the two-point function is given by that minus g 1/2 times the diagram like that, plus ta 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 ta. The four-point function is given by a function like that with a factor g, plus some higher order diagrams, etc. If you want to compute, plus also diagram like that. Okay. So this is n equal 2, n equal 4, number of legs, n equal 6. Contains, so Z of G contains all those correlation functions. So it contains all the contribution of the Feynman diagrams of the quantum field theory. So if you know to compute Z of G using functional integral formalism, you are going to get results of all the correlation functions and the many, many Feynman diagrams at the same time. Okay. So basically, Feynman diagrams are represented like that. You have some external legs. For instance, this is an endpoint function. This is a diagram. You sum over all the diagrams. And you know, for instance, on this example, that in fact, you may very well have connected and disconnected diagrams. So for instance, something like that can be written as a connected diagram plus graphs where you have, you may have two connected diagrams, you may have three connected diagrams, etc. Connected, etc. And in fact, so this is an example of a connected diagram. This is an example of a disconnected diagram, which is in fact, if you know the propagator, you know this. So in fact, in actual calculation, you need only to compute the connected diagrams. Okay. Is there a generating function for connected diagrams? Oh, or generating function such that when you take a partial derivative, you just some kind of correlation function, which are just the contribution of connected Feynman diagrams. And in this generating functional formalism, this is in fact a very easy question, and I will just state the results and will give some argument on Wednesday. I'm going slowly. This generating function for the connected diagram that in my lecture I'm going to call it W of G is just the logarithm. There is a factor h bar, but by normalization, but basically this is the logarithm of this generating function. Remember, this is a function also. To any j, z of g is a number. We can take its log. You get another generating functional. This is the generating functional for the connected diagram. So that's a quite remarkable formula. And for instance, you can compute that if you take W of g for a general theory, which may contain, for instance, pi cube interaction. Well, you compute the delta W of g divided by g at the point x and 1 and at the point x2. Well, you consider that this is a log, so you know the functional derivative of z of g, so you know what this is going to be. And what you find at this is pi of x1, pi of x2 in the theory, minus the expectation value of phi of x1 times the expectation value of phi of x2. Okay, and that's a very easy calculation in this case. Simply you have a function, you take the derivative of the log of a function twice, and you get this minus this, which is in fact called the connected correlation function. Connected correlation, or in mathematics, the cumulant of a variable. And you see that basically this is the sum. This is the sum of all Feynman diagrams or two-point function. And in a general theory, this is going to give you Feynman diagrams between 1 and 2. With all Feynman diagrams, and these Feynman diagrams can be written as in general Feynman diagrams which are connected plus contribution of Feynman diagrams which are disconnected. In phi to the 4, you cannot have correlation functions involving an odd number of fields, but in general, you may. That's the case, for instance, already in QED. In QED, you have diagrams like that. Well, they disappear, but because of some symmetry reason. You have fermions, you have a photon, and these diagrams may be there in QED. And if they are forbidden, it's because of the symmetries of the fermions, not because of.
If you had four, if you wanted to calculate the four-point correlation function, would that thing be minus three terms?
The three-point? Okay, let me finish. So you see, this is this. But this is minus this diagram. One, two.
No.
So you see that this cancels and you get this.
I'm saying if you had a four-point correlation function, instead of phi x1 and phi x2,
yes,
you had x3 and x4.
Yes.
Would that be just minus
the correlator? Yes.
Let's say the two-point correlation function of phi x1, x2, x3, x4.
Yes. No, precisely. You can play the same game, and what you get is that what you get when you get delta W, right, the delta G of X1 up to delta G of X4 at G equals 0, you get, well, if you compute Z, you are getting to get connected diagrams like that, with 1, 2, 3, 4. This is the big diagrams. Then you are going to have 1, 2 times 3, 4, with some diagrams here. But you may also have 1, 3, 2, 4, and you may have 1, 4, 2, 3. But when you compute this, you get this minus this, which is a product of two-point function. So minus this, minus this, so get this is the expectation value of I divide this phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4 for simplicity. Okay. So this is this. This is this. And yet you get minus phi 1, phi 2 times phi 3, phi 4 minus phi 1, phi 3. Phi 2, phi 4, minus phi 1, phi 4, phi 2, phi 3. And that's because I'm dealing with phi 4 theory. So phi to the power n is 0 if n is odd. Otherwise, you would have also plenty of other terms involving one or three. Okay. Anyway, and so you get this minus the same graph, so they cancel. And you get what is called the connected correlation function, or the 4 points cumulant of the random variable phi. So all this diagrammatic of seeing how you can cancel Feynman diagrams comes just out by computing, you know, partial derivative of the logarithm of a function.
Is there a particular order in which we should do the fractional differentiation?
Pardon?
Is there any order in which we should do the fractional differentiation? Like
no, no. There are ordinary differential, there are ordinary partial derivatives. So they commute. You have this Schwarz rule is the same. So they have all the properties of partial derivative, except that they are partial derivative for a function of an infinite number of continuous variables, which is the value of the field, the source term, G, at any point. Otherwise, they obey all the properties of partial derivative. So the calculations are quite simple.
The only difference between Z and W is a log. So when we differentiate, we'll get 1 over Z. And that is somehow subtracting my disconnected diagrams.
Yeah, because when you compute, it's just that, you know, you apply, we can do the calculation if you like. You have a function of two numbers, G1 and G2. Okay, so instead of writing that, let me write that W depends on G1 and G2, J2, okay? So I compute first the partial derivative with respect to G1 J1 of W of G. Okay, this is 1 over Z of G times delta Z of G divided by J1. Okay, so now I compute delta over J2 of this. First, I apply the second derivative on the first derivative, so I get 1 over Z of G times delta squared of Z of G divided by delta of G1 times delta of G2. So this is a second order derivative. But I can also apply it to this, and I get a minus sign here. So I get a 1 over Z squared of G, delta Z of G, K divided by delta Z of G, J divided by J2. Okay, so this is expectation value of phi 1 and phi 2. But each of these terms is expectation value of phi 1 times expectation value of phi 2. You see, just a simple fact. And this generalizes to any number of derivatives. Okay. So this simple object is the generating function of the connected diagrams, Feynman diagrams. Well, time for lunch. Yes. And next time I'm going to speak about another generating function, but I'm not sure I will have much time, but I will show you on very simple example how you recover the Feynman diagrams using this.